Senate State Affairs is called to order. The time is 9:06, and we do have a quorum present for the record, Senators French, Stevens, Bundy, and myself, McGuire. And we have three items on the agenda today. House Bill number 37, establishing Susan Butcher Day. Senate Bill number 201, Public Finance Website, Senator Wilikowski. And Senate Bill number 215, Senator Huggins, Requirements for Driver's License ID. And so first on deck, Representative Guttenberg, tell us about House Bill 37, as if we don't know.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate. Bring before you House Bill 37, a day establishing the first Saturday of March as Susan Butcher Day. In my life, Susan Butcher was larger than life, but I didn't realize how much larger than life she was until I attended her memorial at the University of Alaska Great Hall, where the Gates family attended and George Lucas attended, and other letters of condolences to the family. Starting to realize how much of a person she was on the national level and what she was doing for Alaska. And in that, I decided to introduce this bill, have this bill written and introduce it. And in many ways, it's had a life of its own. Susan, besides being a phenomenal musher, represented Alaska across the nation in a level of Americana that most of us only read about in history books, and, you know, dealing with the people that she dealt with and where she was, and talking with the family, realizing that they downplayed that role in Alaska. You know, they were very down to earth. Susan was a very down to earth person, and David, her husband, is here to talk more about it. But and I'll let other people speak on Susan's behalf as well. But I think this is a good thing to do for the state and for the nation and for Alaskans.
Thank you very much, Representative Guttenberg. Questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go to David Munson. I just want to say on behalf of the committee and the legislature, you've spent a good year testifying and really, I guess I would say, lobbying on behalf of this bill. And I just want to welcome you to Juneau and thank you for your efforts, heartfelt. And I think many lawmakers echo that.
Thank you very much. Well, I've said this before, but honestly, if I had the choice, I wouldn't be here. If I had the choice, I would be home with her. But, you know, life doesn't give you those choices. I always imagined her being 80 years old, walking down the street, very determined, telling people to get out of the way because she had somewhere to go that was important. And that's the way she was in life. That's the way she lived her life. That's why in 50 years she probably got more out of life than all of us. I'm not saying you guys, but I mean, certainly than I will in my life. So I was sitting down this morning and trying to figure out how I condense my 25 years or more with her into the 2 minutes that I'm going to have this morning, and I can't do it. But during this process, I've learned about her things that really have been special to me, you know, I think it comes through the letters that I've gotten from other people that basically she wasn't Susan the musher. She was Susan the idea and the representation of Alaska and the inspiration for young people, because if you look at the files that came in, I was very humbled by the fact that so many people, including military leaders and national media people, and that would think so highly of her. And Melinda was a friend of hers, and she said that Susan helped her find her voice as a woman. And I think that was the thing that struck me, because we got 150 or more letters in 2 weeks in support of this, and most of them were from women that had been inspired by her actions to do whatever it was that they wanted to do. For example, one woman said, you know, if you can be out there on the trail going up against these obstacles, then I can walk across the room to the refrigerator because I have arthritis. And, you know, there was a 7-year-old girl that said, I'm going to grow up to be a doctor. And I know that because you could do something that you weren't supposed to be able to do. Because when she first started racing, people didn't want her to win. She was doing something that women weren't supposed to be doing. And I think, you know, knowing her, she never made that as a complaint. She just decided that she was going to bow her head, do her best, try, and when she failed, try again and again and again. And finally, even though she'd been, you know, attacked by a moose and put out of the race, 1 year she came back the next without regrets and won because of that determination. And I think over the years that sent a message. And the thing about Susan is she was genuine. We met 6 different presidents, and Susan didn't care if they were a president or a plumber. She treated them exactly the same, and she liked them or didn't like them. Honestly.
Don't reveal any.
Yeah, I won't say, and I certainly won't say whether they were Democrats or Republicans. based on them, their personality, their genuineness, and she wasn't afraid to say it either. So I always loved that about her, is that you knew where she stood, and even if you didn't agree with her, you respected the fact that she was willing to share that. You know, it's kind of funny, and as you can see, a little difficult for me to be here today to talk about her. But when I see how much she inspired others, and when I see what she did in a very positive way to bring the image of Alaska of hard work, dedication, self-reliance, love of the wilderness to the people in the United States and in the world, she really served a mighty role in presenting our state in the most positive way and bringing many, many people from, you know, very famous people to just regular folks like me up to Alaska. And I think that served the state well. And I think the idea of serving, of Susan, served the state well and will continue to. She was, in my book, a role model. My children were very, very lucky to have her. I was lucky to have her. And I honestly think the state was lucky to have her. So I'm encouraging you to go forward on this. And honestly, I know you said it took a year to get here. But in that year, I learned things about Susan that I didn't know and probably wouldn't have had I not had the year to pause and reflect and read and hear the really wonderful things that people said about her. So I guess sometimes life gives you what you need, and maybe this was it. So thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Representative Ramirez. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be before the committee to testify. First, let me state my conflict of interest. I used one of Susan Butcher's dogs in a television commercial about in 1986. We used to do food drops for Susan and David during their racing career. I knew them, I've known them for 20 some odd years and have been out to see their kennels and have known them in the day. But my interest in being here today is really on behalf of the state of Alaska. I think that Susan Butcher was such a transcending figure and such an Emerson-like figure of self-reliance, and that she is good for the brand of Alaska and good for the sport of dog mushing, which has its critics, which the state of Alaska always needs to be mindful of in this day and age with the sports figure from the NFL with the cruelty to animals. And that I think that recognizing Susan is not only a positive step for the issues of gender equality, feminism, self-reliance, that bridge between understanding the lower 48 in Alaska, but that it's good for those of us in Alaska. I was at the funeral service for Susan and Herbie Nayukpuk, the human cannonball, who has since passed away, was speaking, and I saw, you know, just a just passing Alaskan history when he was there, because he was not in good health, and his family was up on the stage honoring Susan's memory. And she was such a transcendent figure because of her unique ability to bridge the native, non-native world, which in this building often we search for ways and mechanisms to do that in our finance budget, and we're very sensitive to that in our education system, and in our roles in the judiciary branch, and the way that our laws and our correction systems are structured. And she had a certain majesty in not only being able to connect those two cultures within the state, but then also connecting the state with the lower 48 in a meaningful way. And I think this is quite an appropriate honor, and I think that it will pay significant and tangible dividends to the state of Alaska over time. And we need more legends to come from our state. We don't have very many Paul Revere's folks that rode on the back of the bus and had the courage to go to the front of the bus. And Susan was one of those ladies. So I just wanted to humbly come before the committee as an advocate of Susan Butcher and her memory. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, appreciate your testimony. John Binkley. Did you notice I didn't say Johnny? I'm learning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Committee members, privileged to be here and testify in support of this House bill. Our family has had the privilege of knowing Susan for many, many years. Back in the early 80s, I think it was, she was caring for some muskox in Fairbanks and needed a place for them to reside, and we provided a garage so that she could care for those muskox. Subsequent to that, I had the privilege in serving in this body, and one of the 74 communities that I represented was Manly Hot Springs, where Susan and David resided, so they became constituents of mine. And during the course of that, I got a chance to know them both and helping promote the Iditarod through my position in this body in the legislature. Beyond that, we've had an opportunity, once they moved to Fairbanks, to get to know Susan and David and eventually their two girls as they became a part of our operation in Fairbanks and really providing to many visitors to Alaska a glimpse into what Alaska life is like and some of the larger-than-life characters that we have here in life. So it really has been a privilege to get to know David and Susan and their girls over the course of many years. You know, of course, the Iditarod was really brought to Alaska by Joe Reddington. He's the one that revived that and really gave us the Iditarod race. But what Susan was able to do was really bring the Iditarod to the rest of the country, into the world. And in the course of doing that, it became much more than just the Iditarod and the race. Susan embodied and represented Alaskans in a manner around the world that really reflected well on us as Alaskans, as independent people, where regardless of your gender, you could compete equally of the toughness, the ruggedness, the independence of us as Alaskans were. And I think that what she gave to us in terms of the rest of the country and the rest of the world understanding and knowing us is something that we all should be very, very proud of. And I think this is a unique way that we can really keep that alive of what we as Alaskans are and the spirit that we have. And so with that, I would just encourage you to move this bill forward, and hopefully it becomes enacted, and that we can all look to the memory of Susan Butcher and all be inspired by what she was able to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you. And maybe you could just, one of the, I was thinking about this, and like David said, having the year to think through things, sometimes you come up with additional reasons for support that you might not have had. And, you know, there have been folks that have said, well, what about some of the other Iditarod mushers, and shouldn't they be honored in the same way, or should we have an Iditarod Mushers Day that sort of rotates? And so in thinking about this bill and my justifications, and I just wanted to hear your reflections as a former state senator, I thought about the Elizabeth Paratrowich Gallery as an example. And my thought was that you can make a generalized day, but you sort of lose the legend and the story that goes behind it. And for me, I didn't know who Elizabeth Paratrowich was prior to coming here, and I'm embarrassed to say that. But when I started serving in the House, and I would always turn around and introduce it as the Elizabeth Paratrowich Gallery once I knew her story. And learning that she stood up from that gallery to speak about Native rights and making Alaska really ahead of the civil rights movement, I think was an incredible thing. So for me, I think having a Susan Butcher Day sends along with it a message of a story and a person and a legend, a national hero and a role model for women. But in your time in the state Senate, you can probably remember debates about naming days, and I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on why she would be deserving of a day and how it could be distinguished in your mind.
Well, I don't, to be honest with you, I can't even recall that we had any of those debates. As specifically, there probably were, but they don't come to mind. But I think it does transcend the Iditarod itself. That was the venue, the platform that she really was able to use, but it's more about the personification of her to the rest of the country and to the rest of the world, really, about Alaska and the inspiration that she was through the Iditarod race. But it's really, to me, it's not about the accomplishments in the race itself or about the race. And so that's why I think it's important that we keep it to the person in the day and not try and diminish that by having it just a day to honor those that maybe were a part of the Iditarod or so important in the legend of the Iditarod itself over time. And that's just the way that I look at it.
Thank you. Further thoughts from the committee? Senator Bundy.
Well, you did spark a thought with that.
I knew I would.
Because I've been around that block a time or two with, well, let's not clutter up our statutes with specific days. And there's some merit in that argument. Mm-hmm. And I would agree that we should not clutter up the statutes with days for ordinary, even though all Alaskans are terrific, with ordinary Alaskans. But this is a case of an extraordinary Alaskan, and it certainly, I think, calls for a different view than the ordinary one of cluttering up the statute.
That's a good thought. Yeah, that I wanted to mention it because, you know, obviously that debate has gone on, and it sounds like you weren't a part of it, but we do go through that debate. About whether we should name a specific day. And I think, you know, again, as Senator Bundy said, this is it's a role model, it's an Alaskan story, but it's also a nationwide story and a positive story about the Iditarod, which we don't always, you know, mm-hmm. have as well. So further thoughts, Senator Stevens, Senator French? Okay, thank you. Anyone else in the audience here that would like to testify on House Bill 37? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that will close public testimony and bring the matter of House Bill 37 before the Senate State Affairs Committee. Is there a motion? Senator French.
Madam Chair, I'd be pleased to move that HB 37 be passed out of committee with individual recommendations. And I imagine the attached zero fiscal amount.
So moved. Senator Bundy.
Just an additional comment, if I might, because I've been thinking about this as well, and you know, as well as in addition to the ordinary, extraordinary, and the cluttering up statutes and sort of thing. And there's a lot of exciting things about living in Alaska. But I'm kind of a history buff, and so one of the really extraordinary and exciting things for me about living in Alaska is that our heroes and outstanding accomplishments didn't happen 200 years ago. We still have the really unique opportunity to have known our heroes on a personal level. And if anything, that should probably give us more encouragement to not only pass this bill, but sign on and be strong supporters of it.
Absolutely. Okay, any objection to the motion on the table? Okay, hearing and seeing none, House Bill 37 has passed and out of committee. And thank you very much for being here. Many folks here from Fairbanks today, we appreciate you coming all the way to Juneau and hearing your voices. Okay, that brings Senate Bill number 201 by Senator Wilikowski before us. Senator Thomas, I meant to acknowledge you. Thank you for being present in the room.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
for acknowledging me.
Yes, thank you, Dean. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 201, also known or referred to as the Alaska Open Government Act, mandates the creation of a free searchable website to provide Alaskans with easy access so they can find out comprehensive information on state spending, expenditures, and revenues. We believe such a website will foster better understanding of state operations, ultimately reduce waste, and ensure funding is directed to the state's most important needs. I'll read a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who said, we might hope to see the finances of the Union as clear and intelligible as a merchant's book, so that every member of Congress and every man of any mind in the Union should be able to comprehend them, to investigate abuses, and consequently to control them. These types of websites are occurring all over the country. In 2006, President Bush signed the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act. This act calls for the creation of a searchable website. You can go online and find it at federalspending.gov. Interestingly, that legislation was introduced by a bipartisan team of four United States senators, including Senators John McCain and Barack Obama. In 2007, five states passed legislation mandating the creation of online databases with detailed information on their state's expenditures. Those states were Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Hawaii. And currently, there are 15 states who are looking at similar types of legislation. There seems to be a national consensus emerging. And it's really supported by both ends of the political spectrum, from Ralph Nader to Grover Norquist, that taxpayers should be able to easily track and help direct government spending. I first learned about these efforts when I was at these so-called Taxpayer Transparency Acts, when I was at a National Conference of State Legislatures last summer. And I understand that this is also an issue that the governor has embraced, and I applaud her for her commitment to begin the implementation of such a system. I know that Commissioner Kreitzer and her Chief Finance Officer Kim Gonero have already taken strides to getting such a system online. We've met with them, we've worked with them to try to craft legislation that we can do, and actually we have a zero fiscal note on this. And I think it's important that the legislature put this in statute so that we have some control over what exactly is searchable, what is online. And I think it's good. It's a good opportunity for the legislature to signal to the public that this is something that we strongly believe in and that should be enshrined in statute. So I'd urge you to support SB 201 and the right of all Alaskans to easily access accessible and detailed information about how their dollars are being spent. And I have a letter of support, which my office just received yesterday, which, if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I would pass out. It's from Grover Norquist.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions for Senator Wilikowski. Senator Bundy.
I certainly applaud and support the idea that citizens not only have more information, but make it easy for them to get involved, because as you and I know, it's hard sometimes for our folks to get here and see us. My only question is the zero fiscal note. It seems difficult for me to imagine that constructing this information won't involve some kind of cost, and I'm certainly willing to look at that cost and support it. It's hard for me to understand a zero fiscal note, if you could help me with that.
And actually, if you look at Grover Norquist's letter of support, he talks about how this is being done in these other states for really nominal amounts of money. And my understanding is the administration is going to do this with simply an Excel spreadsheet. And so it will involve some time, but and perhaps the administration can come up and explain. As I mentioned, they have embraced this, and they have headed towards this direction. So last year we did actually fund money in the budget to allow them to update their computer systems, and so I think that money is being used towards this effort as well.
Okay. Yeah. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I see here that it was predicted in Oklahoma to cost $300,000 and end up costing $8,000. Well, if we're going to have transparency, even at $8,000, I think we should probably have the. Again, it's de minimis, but just for accuracy.
Absolutely, and we will have Kim Guarnero is here as well. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if we can write de minimis on the fiscal note and just have that work.
I think the square.
Add a new category, indeterminate de minimis.
I just want to thank the sponsor for bringing this piece of legislation forward, and because this is an idea that had percolated around my mind for some time. I've had one of the more stimulating conversations I ever had with a constituent was about this exact idea. About how, you know, he wanted to know where the state government was spending its money. He wanted to know right down to the light bulb, you know, where the money was going. And it is the public's money. It is their right to know. It's absolutely, perfectly in keeping with, you know, the way government ought to work, which is bring the information to you. You shouldn't have to go off to a dusty book and, you know, an LIO downtown and park and go in and get your parking pass, go back out, go upstairs, you know, and go through all those motions when the internet is bringing this information right to your desktop. So, it's a great idea. I'll be signing on as a co-sponsor, and I just want to thank you for having the initiative to get it in front of us and get it rolling through the building.
Thank you. And I guess I should add, we're not really putting anything new out there. All this information is out there. It's just pretty much compiling it in an easy searchable database so that the public can go and find it. You can find anyone who's tried to search through one of our budgets, hundreds of pages, knows how difficult that can be, and this will just put it in one simple, easily accessible place.
Be helpful for us. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And absolutely no disrespect, believe me, Senator, but the governor is already doing this. It's already funded through the governor's budget. The Division of Finance is billing the website. Are we just saying me too, or is there something we can really add as the legislature to this process?
That's a good question. And we've worked with the governor's office to try to craft something that is acceptable to them, acceptable to us. And I guess from my perspective, it's and it's open for a legislative discussion. If the legislature feels that this is something we want to cede to the executive branch, I'll respect that decision. I guess from my perspective as a legislator, I feel this is something that is important. We're the ones who are supposed to craft and develop and appropriate the budget. And so I think this is something that we should have some kind of a stamp on. And this governor is open and transparent, and that's a good thing. And I guess from my perspective, I'd like to see this enshrined so that further governors have to do this, and that there's just really no doubt about it, that this will happen in the future. And also, I think it gives us a say on what kind of things we may want to have accessible, and maybe there are some kind of confidential things, quite frankly, that we don't want to be accessible. And I think that's something that it kind of comes down to this question of at what point do we as a legislature say this is something that's important to us and we want to have our stamp on it.
Senator Stevens.
So if I understand it right, then what you're saying is that this governor may support this, a future governor may not, and this is one way to make sure that it'll happen well into the future.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think, too, I don't know if it has, does it have a judiciary referral?
No.
But, you know, one thing to think about is in terms of information, it might give the legislature an opportunity to look at, you know, matters of personnel and things like that. Perhaps we want to consider what types of things you wouldn't want to have, social security numbers, I don't know, you know, certain things that involve, you know, I'm just thinking right now, off the top of my head, if it's state expenditures, is it salaries? And if it is salaries, should we put them in categories as opposed to individual names? Have you thought of that?
No, that's actually an excellent point. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's helpful for us to have the debate and discuss it and figure out. Our bill does not include salaries, and we do not include state or federal assistance. And that's a policy call that we made in the bill. If this committee or the body decides to do otherwise, then we can certainly have that discussion.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
State assistance, could you help me understand what?
Right, welfare.
Well, we should have the totals we spend on welfare.
Absolutely.
Not to an individual by
but
name.
Not the individual.
Absolutely. And I think, again, that's a policy call. That's the legislature saying we think it's important to have that information out there. I don't know that we want to start listing everyone that's receiving state assistance on the website.
Okay.
This might get a little smaller if we did, though.
Okay, so do you want to, just briefly on that point then, do you want to, before I go to the public testimony, walk through any additional categories that you chose to exclude and perhaps reasoning behind that?
That's really it. And
okay.
If you look at page 2 of the bill, lines 30 through 31, we define what an expenditure is. And again, we currently define it as something that's greater than $10,000.
Okay.
And I would be open to lowering that if to say $1,000. I guess there at some point in time, do you want to list every 99-cent purchase of paper clips and tape or things like that? So at some point you probably want to have some kind of a lower limit, I would think. We set it at 10,000, but I would be open certainly to lowering that to say 1,000.
Okay, so salaries. And public assistance, those are the two categories
right.
They have so far.
And I can read it on page 2, line 30. It says, expenditure does not include the transfer of money between state agencies, payment to state employees or retirees, or payment of state or federal assistance to an individual. So those are the things that we've excluded.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, Senator French, I think, was
ahead. Oh, Senator French. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just... in order to make the record clear, we should probably discuss what's on page 2, lines 11 to 17, which describes expenditures for the preceding fiscal quarter, including the name and location of any person to whom payment was made. What we're making clear on the record is that does not include a payment to a state employee or retiree, so it would not be a salary of, you know, a state employee, but it would be, I guess you're referring to a contract, a buy, a purchase.
Yes.
Things along those lines.
That's correct.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
And once again, to help me understand, on line 31, you say payment to state employees. Would it be more accurate to say individual employees rather than we paid X amount of dollars for the administrative assistance right. in some department?
I I've looked at some of the other websites that are out there. And typically what they'll have is they'll have right on their first page somewhere where you can go on and they'll have a pie chart, for instance, of where all your money is going. And so certainly the labor costs are a large cost that the state has, and I think we should have those costs on there. I think when you start maybe naming specific employees and how much people make, you can get that information. I just don't know that that's something we want to put on a searchable website.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I agree. I just... Again, trying to clarify and, for myself that it would be in categories where the Department of Administration has these kinds of labor expenses, but not categorized by individual.
That would be my intention, and if it's not clear enough in here, then the committee
perhaps
decides.
We, you know, on line 31, one idea would be to say individual payments to state employees or retirees. Just a thought, but we can think about that, because I think somebody's right that you wouldn't want to exclude the general payment for purposes of, you know, categorizing you know, what we spend in Department of Revenue, what we spend in Department of Natural Resources, and so forth.
And I would be open to that.
Senator Bundy?
Yeah. And I agree with Senator Wilikowski on the 10,000. I don't know what the right number is. I'm sure for a lot of regular Alaskans, $10,000 sounds significant, and certainly would for me. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what the correct number is, but I'd enjoy hearing some additional conversation as to. Mm-hmm. I agree. You don't want to get down to the end of the pennies, but at some point, there needs to be a line.
I would be open to that as well.
Okay. Further discussion? Questions for Senator Wilikowski? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we'll go on to public testimony. We have John Binkley back on deck here.
John,
you're
Binkley
making
Day,
the most out of his trip here. Look at this.
Trying to stay.
Welcome.
Some people do anything to get out of the cold.
Yeah, right. Thank you again, Madam Chair and committee members. I first want to applaud Senator Wilikowski and also Governor Palin for their initiatives in going forward with this. I think it's a wonderful idea that really does open up state government. And as Senator Bundy said, there's just not too much that we can do to ensure that people have access so that they do have trust in what is going on in state government. I first became aware of this concept in 2006. During the course of my travels around the state and talking and thinking about state government and changes that we could possibly make. And I'm just pleased that it's coming to fruition now and that the administration has really taken the initiative to make this happen. I think, though, that just in the course of sitting here, and so I wanted to offer my support for this legislation, but in the course of sitting here and listening to some of the questions and thinking about it, there are a lot of details that are going to be involved in this, and I think it's going to be a learning process as the administration goes forward and starts to implement this and actually get it up onto line, and there will be a lot of questions that will arise as a result of that process, things that you can't foresee now that as they mechanically start to put this together will become more apparent. And one note of caution would be that in the course of codifying this as legislation, that you don't lock something in inadvertently that would preclude you from doing something that would be beneficial in constructing this website and providing more access for the public. So. I don't know how to get around that, but I'm sure that as they develop this, they're going to learn a lot more as they go along. And I don't know if it would be appropriate to pass the bill now and then come back and modify it if you needed to make certain that the law coincided with what actually worked in getting the website up and dealing with some of these nuances that are going to become apparent.
And we will, those are good points. We will hear from the administration today, and then we'll go ahead and we'll hold the bill over till next week and make sure that your office and all of us communicate, because I think that's a good note of caution that you want to be careful that you don't restrict yourself from doing the good work that you'd like it to do, and there may be things that we can't think of right now today. Looking forward to Senator Bundy.
Thank you. If I can plow your wisdom, explore your wisdom a little bit in your travels and scope of having talked to a lot of Alaskans. I see a path to walk to be a little cautious on either side. You don't want to just basically inundate the citizen with so much information that it's not usable. And then, of course, we don't want to make it difficult or a lack of clarity. And on the amount of what should be reported as an expenditure, and you know, we get down into the pennies, we're burdening people with too much information, we cut it too high, we may reduce public confidence that we in government don't think $10,000 is an expenditure where the citizen would. Do you have any thoughts about what the appropriate level would be?
Well, I think it probably depends on the mechanism within the administration and how they have that data arranged. I think that if it's accessible, then there's no harm in allowing people to drill down, so to speak, to a very, very small amount. Something at the Alaska Railroad that we have is similar is in the capital projects, and it's something that I worked with the IT department in developing so that I could see exactly where we were on some of our capital projects on expenditures. And so I can take a broader view of where we're at, or I can start to drill down to many different levels. All the information is captured within our computer system, and so it's all accessible. And so it was very easy for them really to get the links to be able to go down to the level that I wanted to get of detail. And maybe I'd stop at a level much higher, but if I was really interested in where every last penny was going, and it didn't really take any more effort for them to allow me to get access to that, then I can drill right down to a very small amount.
And Senator Bundy?
Of course, brings to mind another question. Have you had any experience with people hacking into a system like that and causing any mischief?
Not that I'm aware of, at least from the railroad's standpoint.
Yeah, I can see a creative eighth grader who could change expenditures for us.
Get into the checkbook.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you. It's probably worth having a debate while we're here in committee. I think we're all in agreement that salaries of state employees should not be on the searchable database. But, you know, it's probably worth thinking about, you know, why we're all leaning that direction. I don't know if you've all read the budget report that used to come out every other week. They're taking a hiatus this year. But at the back of the budget report was always a list of the comings and goings of state employees and their salaries. And I know it's a matter of some concern about what state employees get paid. And while I'm not advocating for the inclusion, we should probably, you know, think about whether other states are including that information in their implementation of this idea, and if not, why not, and if so, why? Because I can imagine that there are members of the public who would be interested in that one subject only. You know, they're not interested in what you're paying for light bulbs, but they are interested in what you're paying, for state troopers, us, for our staff, for the folks that make up the thousands of state employees. So it's just worth thinking about, you know, what the arguments are, pro and con.
Yeah, it's a good point. Okay, any questions for John Bigley? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Steve Cleary waiting patiently.
Hi, Madam Chair, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thanks. For the record, my name is Steve Cleary. I'm the Executive Director of ACPIRG, the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. ACPIRG's been around since 1974 with the mission of protecting consumers and making or advocating for more responsive government. I'm here today to support SB 201. We think it's a great idea and optimistic that it will help both help you all out and help out regular citizens as well. ACPIRG endeavors to get more people involved in civic affairs, and I think there's no easier way to do that than through pocketbook issues. And so giving Alaskans the opportunity and the ability to search where their state funds are going, we believe will be a good way to get people more involved and engaged in civic affairs. And perhaps I naively hope that some folks will use that to heap praise on their legislators and tell them what a good job they're doing in certain areas, but I realize that it also will be a method for people to be critical of where the money is going. But both those, I think, are worthy things for citizens to be able to access and be able to use in order to make, as Senator Wilikowski has stated, make state government more more efficient. And we've pretty much gone over the other things I had to say. You know, other states are doing it. The federal government has begun it. And so I think it would be useful for Alaska to be able to learn from those other states and see, you know, all the questions, the great questions that have been raised in committee today. You know, are other states doing that? Do they have a website already set up that Alaska could use and could adopt very very cheaply? But as a general concept, I think this is a great idea, and we really hope that it will help get people more involved and engaged in state government. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Steve. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, and hi, Steve. I think that probably having this available will not change that widely held Alaskan view that excess state spending is just money that goes to someone else. But I'm more importantly, I'm interested in your thoughts about Senator French's question as to whether individual salaries should be listed.
Thanks, Senator Bunny. Through the chair, I think what people are concerned about isn't so much the person, but the job. So, as I think about it, kind of off the top of my head right now, I would say that you know people do want to know what state troopers for that case that he brought up, or state legislators, are paid. I don't think they're necessarily looking for the name of that person. So, I was thinking, I guess, originally. That those salaries would be listed in the aggregate or as a range as they are, I assume on the state website now. So, I think in my my view, people are more interested in what a state trooper makes and not the specific trooper him or herself.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. So perhaps a categories with the high end and the low end, something like that. Okay, further questions for Steve Cleary. Okay, thank you very much. Mead Treadwell with Alaskans for Tax Reform.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Mead Treadwell. Many of you know me as a senior fellow at the Institute of the North or in other positions I hold. At the invitation of Grover Norquist, I've worked with a few Alaskans to help establish a chapter of Americans for Tax Reform called Alaskans for Tax Reform. And one of the reasons why I'm very pleased to see this legislation is because we'd actually drafted legislation similar to it to try to do as a voter initiative. And I'm delighted to see that Senator Wilikowski has put it forward. Likewise, I want to also congratulate Governor Palin and Commissioner Kreitzer for their leadership in moving forward and doing this right away. Just a couple of different things. Grover Norquist and I first met in Berlin on New Year's Eve 1989 as we were part of a group of people there to tear down the Berlin Wall. And what struck me then, which was my second visit to a communist country, was that how much the government relied on secrecy to do bad things to people. And I've always been concerned that we have more open and transparent government, and I think this is a very valuable thing to see because ultimately it promotes freedom and it promotes liberty. The second thing is I saw the need for this database myself just recently. We did a program at Commonwealth North in Anchorage, where we were trying to report to Alaskans on the management of our commonly owned assets and where we had gained taxes from certain resources and so forth. And that information was not immediately available to us. It took a lot of phoning, a lot of cajoling, and a lot of updating to make that that information available. And so I think that what the bill calls for here is also very important. So I support the legislation. I just wanted to comment on a couple of aspects that have come up in the discussion today. As we looked at other legislation around the country on this, some states actually went so far as to create a commission to further update this process. And in talking with Senator Wilikowski's staff on this and so forth, I commend his decision not to include that kind of extra continuing cost provision in the legislation, but I do think you might do something that Congress occasionally does, which is require an annual report to the legislature, or perhaps encourage the commissioner, governor, to create an annual executive order that might update and make more information available via this process and enshrine it over time. And as you know, a governor's executive order can be kind of voted down by the legislature, but otherwise it moves forward. So some kind of process in the bill to continually improve this this window, I think, would be something the committee might want to consider. The second thing about databases is, you know, where we have a criminal database, there are certain restrictions on its use. As you know, for I don't know what it is with APOC, but I know in the federal government you're not supposed to use campaign databases for soliciting campaign contributions. In a case like this, I think you want to have the information out there transparently, but you don't want to. You may want to have some sort of restriction on database mining to create mailing lists or to solicit people who receive state contracts for campaign contributions or something like that. I haven't thought that through, but I would just look at those issues. The third issue, in terms of salaries and privacy issues, I was a state official. My salary was public. I was looking on the state directory the other day, and the PCN for every employee that you can look up is there. I don't know how you match the PCN to the budget number. My father was mayor of a small town in Connecticut, and I remember reading in the annual report of the town every year that his salary was half that of the superintendent of schools. But I don't think it hurts to have a public official's salary openly available. And in fact, I believe that any information that is now FOIA-able should be ultimately on this database in terms of financial information. So that's where I come down on that particular issue. With that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to support what you're considering doing today and congratulate all involved.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mead? Senator Bundy.
Just listening to your thoughts on the salary, and obviously when you're in the public arena, salaries do get published. How about the welfare recipients? That information is available, but should it be available to the public?
Well, I don't know how available it is. If I wanted to find out if you were on welfare, I don't think that's. I think that's the type of thing that could be shielded under privacy. Likewise, if I'm under medical assistance and I frankly want to maintain the privacy about whatever disease I'm fighting, I think you should have that as well too. Some sort of privacy provision or shield should either be in the legislation or a process by which a person may petition or request that might also be in the legislation.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Mead. Okay, and then I have Kim Garner with the Division of Finance. Any thoughts you want to put on the record on behalf of the administration?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kim Garnero. I work as the Director of Finance in the Department of Administration. We would be the organization that would build this under the legislation. In fact, we already are building it, as has been said here earlier today. I just want to give you a little bit of history. Our accounting system is very old. Come up in 1985, built in COBOL, needs to be replaced. You guys have started the support of that replacement effort with an appropriation that we are using to build what we're calling the Alaska Data Enterprise Reporting System, or ALDER. That is a reporting system that is going to enable us to put this thing on the web. It also, more importantly, I think, is going to allow us to shut down our old systems when we get the replacements up. It's building the foundation for converting that legacy data. So that's why we're building it, but being able to do reporting such as this is a benefit of doing it. We're in the middle of building it right now. We got financial information pretty much. It's in field test with state departments right now. We have over 400 users out there. That's the report that we are showing to stakeholders at 11 o'clock this morning. If it meets with their approval, it will be posted on the web tonight and available for you to see tomorrow. What will be in it is all state expenditures that were, the payment was over $1,000. Okay? It's going to be sorted by department and by what we call account code, which shows the purpose of the expenditure, in-state airfare, not light bulbs, I'm afraid, but office supplies, the lowest level, the most granularity we have in our accounting system. increment two of ALDER is going to move our payroll data into that reporting database. At that point, we would be able to do some of the reporting you guys have been talking about. How much do state troopers cost? How much does a state trooper cost? That sort of thing. At this point, that kind of reporting is not available to us. We expect to have the payroll data in ALDER before August.
Okay.
One big concern is posting any information that's confidential. We want to prevent that. So what we're posting, what we prepared as version one for the financial information, excludes all payments to beneficiaries of any kind that are coded as beneficiary payments. We've excluded all warrants that are recorded as confidential warrants in our accounting system. And we've let agencies see what we're going to post. They've looked at it in the last 72 hours. And the ones that they told us they really have concerns about the confidentiality, we pulled out last night. We were here till about 9 o'clock last night pulling them out. So we're working hard on that confidentiality thing. What it means is, at the beginning, there could be things that are excluded that really aren't truly confidential. We are going to, our Office of Management and Budget is going to request the Department of Law to perform a confidentiality analysis of all our payment systems. We have a lot of payment systems that are specialized, heating assistance, foster care payments, those sorts of things. None of that stuff's going out there until there's a confidentiality analysis completed.
On that point,
yes.
But it would be in a general category reported that the state spent X amount of money on heating assistance last year, but not to the individual.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, not in version one. It's something I've made notes on that you guys are thinking about, and we could think about that for future versions. In fact, I'll be talking about it with our stakeholders at our meeting at 11 this morning.
Okay. And on that point, yeah, I think that's a great idea to get categories. So I think people would want to know, you know, generally what are we spending on, you know, X category. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is that we will make a difference between employees and beneficiaries. So beneficiaries you would not show, employees you would. Did I understand that correctly?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, no payroll warrants will be posted. If an estate employee has received a travel reimbursement payment of over $1,000, that will show out there.
But no salaries or categories of
no salaries. No permanent fund dividends, no retirement checks. Mm-hmm.
That's right, permanent fund dividend checks. Senator French.
Thank you. So as to, let's just use the state troopers as an example. Would a citizen be able to figure out what state troopers get paid? That is, you know, how many state troopers are there? What's the total salary? You know, would you have to do the division to figure out, you know, the sort of the annual salary, or would there be some more information about that? How would that work?
Senator French, through the chair, we have not anticipated posting salary information. It's open to design.
And if I can continue, is that public information now? If someone, I think Mr. Treadwell used a word, FOIA-able, which he may have just coined, or maybe it's out there in the lingo, but I understood what he meant, and I think he probably understood what he meant. You know, is that information, you know, disclosable upon a Freedom of Information Act or an open records request?
Senator French, through the chair, elements that make up gross pay for state employees is considered public information. Elements that make up net pay is considered confidential under Title 39.
And just break that down a little more. When you say gross pay, do you mean by category or do you mean by individual?
Gross pay for an individual public servant.
Okay. So if someone said, you know, my neighbor's a state trooper, his name is, Joe Smith. What is Joe Smith's salary? You know, he files the paperwork, and he would get back in the mail a month later the gross salary for his neighbor, the state trooper. Is that right?
Senator French, to the chair, that's my understanding.
Okay. Do you get those requests? And would they come to you?
They do not come to the Division of Finance. They go to the Division of Personnel.
Senator Stevens and Bundy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciated Mr. Treadwell's comment about an annual report to the legislature, though I might recommend that it be for the two-year period of the legislature sets rather than every year. Does that make sense to you, that we might have an opportunity to receive an annual report from partly from your office, and find out if there are things we should be adding or removing from that list. Would that make sense to you?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, hadn't thought about an annual report, don't know what it would really look like. I had envisioned, personally as the project manager on this, that we would have an ongoing governance group that would assist us in determining future enhancements. And I would be delighted if members of the legislature would like to participate in that.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you. Again, the goal is more confidence than for the general public and the government. We've got to be careful of unintended consequences. And if we're going to leave large categories unreported, then surely there's someone sitting somewhere with a spreadsheet or a computer or a pencil taking total expenditures, yeah, what we've reported, and there's going to be a big gap. And they say, aha, what are they trying to hide? And so I guess that's just an encouragement to think about putting in the categories. And I have another topic, if I might. You are currently changing your computer software system, apparently. That's correct?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we are just beginning that process.
Yeah. And that's not related to this bill. You were going to do that anyway.
That has to be done.
Yeah. And the reason I bring that up, I was talking to another department, Division of Revenue, asking about auditing of corporate income tax. And for them to do a really good job and get any folks that are skating, it's going to cost tens of millions of dollars in new software. So apparently, we don't have a big fiscal note because you're already doing that, but that's a really substantial expense to get your software up to speed.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, this ALDER is being built from a $20 million appropriation that you previously made. We are anticipating we're going to be able to also do a time and attendance system, which will act as a front end to our existing payroll system with that $20 million. Last year, you appropriated $41 million in debt to us to start further replacement efforts, and there's going to be a lot more necessary before it's done.
Senator Bundy, and wrap up.
It's expensive to count beans.
Yes, it is. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Grover Norquist, briefly.
It's Grover Norquist.
Thank you. You want to go ahead and offer testimony on Senate Bill 201?
Yes, certainly. I run Americans for Tax Reform, which is a national taxpayer organization, and we've been working with governors and state legislators around the country to enact both legislation or executive orders that do what SB 201 does. The federal government has passed a law which makes a lot of the actual spending of the federal government now transparent. You can go to www.usaspending.gov. And see a great deal of the spending there. But really, five states have moved very far on this, and you can actually see the success they've had. Missouri did this by executive order. They didn't have to appropriate a penny. The governor said, do this with existing staff and resources. 2 million people in Missouri have gone to the website, to 2 million unique visitors to take a look at the information. I just spoke with the woman who is the comptroller in Texas, Susan Combs, and they've saved millions of dollars just by having, they put every expenditure, every check on the web searchable. So when you buy a pencil in Texas, it goes on the web within 2 days of the expenditure. And it's not only good for citizens to be able to look and see how their tax dollars are being spent, but they found that internally they had no idea looking from department to department. They save $75,000 a year consolidating their purchases of toner, for heaven's sakes. And they just had no idea where they were buying it and how much. But when you can go on the web and search toner and find out who's spending how much in the government. It's not just something that citizens can use, which is great and helpful for citizens to know how their money is being spent, but it's a tool for the government employees as well to figure out how to spend less money. So Missouri's done it by executive order. Texas started by executive order and passed legislation. South Carolina, the governor's done an executive order that will be up and running by March of this coming year, of this year. Florida will pass a law in March to require not just the state to put all expenditures online, but every local government and every school district. Ohio is just introducing legislation to require the state, all schools, all towns and cities to have complete fiscal transparency. In Texas, the governor required that if you're a school district and you can't show that you're spending 65% of your education budget in the classroom, you have to put your actual check register, every check that the school district writes, up on the web, searchable. 58 counties that represent 20% of the students in Texas do that, and they're now going to require that for all schools. So every parent can go and see every check written by the school district. And so this, among other things, it stops all sorts of abuses, and it makes sure that people are spending the money more reasonably, but it also lets parents and taxpayers go in and say, now, explain this to me, please. So I think what you're looking to do in Senate Bill 201 is extremely exciting. It's not risky or dangerous or odd. A number of states have already done this now and found it to be extremely helpful in saving resources and making sure that people have access to all of this information. Oklahoma has passed this legislation. Kansas has. Minnesota and Hawaii have done a little watered-down versions. My only recommendation looking at the legislation is that there's a $10,000 threshold for disclosure. I think you'll find that it's not that difficult to simply do all expenditures and make sure that you don't, because otherwise you'll end up with a lot of $9,000 checks being written. And, you know, starting at $10,000 threshold, if that makes people feel more comfortable, maybe fine, but I think you'll find you can go beyond that. And you might want to talk to the people in Missouri and in Texas who manage this, because they have not found it difficult to go down to literally the pencil level. You write a check to buy a pencil or 100 pencils, and that goes up on the web there. And so I think that's one thing to take a look at. At our website at Americans for Tax Reform, ATR.org, we have all the information that we're aware of the status of transparency at the federal, state, and local level. And there you have the websites that are up in Texas, that are up in Missouri, and the legislation, the actual wording of the legislation that's passed in Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas and Hawaii and Minnesota. And we can, when you go to set it up, the folks who manage this in Texas and who manage it in Missouri have been willing to talk to people in other states to say, here are the things we did, here's what took us longer or less long than we thought. But in Texas, this was up and running in months, and the same thing in Missouri.
Thank you very much, Grover. We appreciate your testimony.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Take care.
Thank you very much. Anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 201? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll close public testimony, and we'll go ahead and hold the bill over till next week, just to be sure that what the folks in the administration are putting online, sounds like tomorrow, perhaps, comports with this bill, and so if we get a chance to talk sometime this week, to be sure. Okay, so we'll set Senate Bill 201 to the side. Senator Stevens.
Mr. Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask the Senator, if you could give some response, maybe at our next meeting on, have you considered extending this to local governments and school districts in Alaska?
Great. Okay. So now we have Senate Bill 215 and the bill sponsor, Senator Huggins.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me be clear that Debbie Grunman is a subject matter expert, and if she's not enough an expert on it, my good friend Dwayne Bannock is here, a local resident now in Juneau. But let me go to Senate Bill 215 and an act relating to issuance of identification cards and to issuance of driver's license and providing for an effective date. You know, there's a number of people talk about what this does or does not do. It essentially does two things. Simple. It's required that an applicant for Alaska state driver's license or a state identification card, either of those, you have to be a citizen of this country or you have to be legally present in this country. Very simple. And I don't think it's any stretch of the imagination when you go out and talk to Alaskans and across the country, they're very sensitive to this issue of people coming here and exploiting our system when they're not here legally. And I think that's important for us. Now, it has some ramifications, and Debbie Grumman can speak to that more eloquently than I. But let's just say that you are here as a student. And your student visa, for lack of a better term. And if that's for 1 year, then and you got a driver's license, it's good for 1 year. And then if you get an additional year for graduate school or whatever the case may be, you will have to go get another driver's license or another ID card. You know, that, I mean, that's just, and that allows us as a state, number one, to know people that are here within our borders that, quite frankly, aren't residents, but they're legally here. So that's a mechanism that this does bring forward. Now, I would remind you that last year, or correction, in 2006, Senate Bill 189 passed the Senate 17-1 with two excused. And most of the people I'm looking at here voted for it, and I know that Madam Chair was not in the Senate at that point in time, but I'm sure would hardly entertained the robustness of it. And Representative Lynn, Bob Lynn, my good friend, who has certainly done some great work in the other body, is he has the real bill, for lack of a better term. This is a companion bill to his. And just so that you understand, our methodology here is I'm supporting his cause for Alaskans, and if we need to merge those at some point in time based on timing, that's the intent of this. But that does not subordinate how important I think this is to Alaskans. I mean, go walk down the streets and ask them about how supportive they are about people that are illegal in our state exploiting our system. And this is one way to keep that at bay. So with that, Ms. Grumman is here. My good friend Dwayne Bannock is here, but I'll be prepared to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. And I apologize, by the way, too. We got a little bit backed up, and I want to say this to both the senator and folks here to testify. We're going to have to – we've got a couple of us are here meeting at 10:30, so without any deference to the bill, we're going to continue on next week. So my apologies
sure,
on that.
Fair enough.
Senator Bundy.
Just an inquiry, if I had some information, if you're interested, I'd be glad to share it with you. In another line of questioning, I've just received some information, the number of illegal aliens who were involved in crime and then consequently deported or moved to another state and then for other deportation, and it's 200 or 300 a year. So if you're interested in having that information, I'll
yeah, no, absolutely, Senator Bundy. And, you know, we as Americans, to be quite frank, in my estimation, having lived around the world in multiple countries, are very, very naive on this subject. And what is happening, there is networking going on, and people are being transported. I mean, the worst, obviously, is down on the southern border in some cases, but it doesn't matter whether it's people that have the capacity to create havoc in our country based on terrorism, or the fact that they're transporting drugs, or it's just that they're being paid to move people. That same networking is happening within states where people are being moved, and Senator Bundy hit right on it, when things are getting a little bit warmed as far as preventive measures in state X, they may move to state Y, which is Alaska.
Yeah.
So in any event, I just ask that you entertain the thought of this and remember the precedents of support we had previously.
Yeah.
Ms. Grumman?
Further questions for Senator Huggins before he, okay. Further questions for Deborah? I most of us are familiar, you know, with the bill. So I'm going to go ahead and get to the folks here to testify that have come all the way down. I'm going to try to get through you. So if you can, Dwayne, you're on deck. Dwayne Bannock.
Good morning, Senators.
Morning.
Thank you for the wonderful opportunity to be here. It is a fact. I've been in this committee before and seen your cheerful faces in a different role. Today I'm here just for the fun of it. And I must say, nearly five years of my life was some of the most enjoyable parts of my life in this involvement. But I'm not here today. We've talked about this bill. Most of you and I have spoken about this bill in the past. It was an important bill to me when it was about my job. It's an important bill to me today when it doesn't have anything to do about my job. So Senator Huggins has done an excellent job of wrapping up the bill for you, and there's just a couple of little tiny points that if I may add, and I'll be incredibly brief with them. There's a lot of knocks about this bill. Go back in time with me just a couple of years ago, the great state of California. And the great state of California had a governor that was pressing almost the opposite of this bill. Because you see, these rules as proposed are relatively similar to the rules in the great state of California. Oh. Great state of California, probably a state that understands illegal alien population greater than any other organized government does. That governor was Gray Davis. And if you were to point to any one reason, the number one reason why Gray Davis was probably recalled, you could say it was his stance that illegal aliens should have state-issued driver's licenses and identification cards. And I'll just give you that as an opinion, but if you read every poll and every suggestion and every editorial pertaining to Gray Davis, Governor Gray Davis lost his job because he supported the opposite of this bill. This bill is simply about preventing people that are illegally in the United States of America from obtaining or having an Alaska driver's license or identification card. The bill's broken up into two pieces. First part of it is the statutory section for identification cards. The second portion of it is statutory sections pertaining to the driver's license. The biggest difference between the bill that Senator Huggins had previously referenced that did pass the Senate is sections 1 and 2. I will tell you that sections 1 and 2 are in there for a time and money-saving reasons. Under current state law, a 60-year-old person is allowed to get a free 5-year identification card. They don't pay anything for it. So if you came in on your 60th birthday, you'd get a free one. When you come in on your 65th birthday, you'd get a free one. When you come in on your 70th birthday, you would get a free one. Under this bill, instead of it being a 5-year window, it's now an 8-year window. So we've eliminated one visit every 15 years for that particular senior citizen. Since it costs the state to produce that card, every time the state gives one away, there is a cost to it. By giving less of them away, it's a money-saving thing. By having less senior citizens standing in line to get things done, it is also a time-saving feature. That's the fundamental difference between Senate Bill 189 from the 24th session and this particular bill. And then finally, just briefly, what this bill is not. This bill is not about a national ID card. It's not about a national database. It's not about implementation of computer chips and radio frequency identification devices, and it's not about Big Brother. If you believe that illegal aliens should not be allowed to have a valid Alaska driver's license or identification card, I urge your yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Dwayne, can you be online next week?
I bet I can be here for you, Senator.
Okay, that's right. You're here. You're local. Okay.
Yes, I am.
Because what I'd like to be able to do just to the committee, so the committee knows, is I'd like to allow the folks that are here to testify briefly. And, Gary, I might have to pass the gavel to you at 10:30. But there's four folks, and I'd like them, since they're here in the audience, to be able to testify, and we'll bring it back up next
Thank you,
week.
Senators.
Okay, thank you. So next is Scott McMurrin.
Madam Chair, my name is Scott McMurrin. I'm Dwayne Bannock's a great friend of mine. And we see differently on this particular issue, on this particular bill. I see this bill, and, you know, I'm not an illegal alien. I'm not an illegal resident. I am a traveler, and that's how I got involved in what has become this big debate with regard to Real ID. I regard this particular bill as seeing the legislature pass off their oversight with regard to DMV and what requirements will be required for a driver's license to make it a backdoor to compliance with Real ID, which I oppose. Real ID is a bad thing. We don't need big national databases on travelers who have done nothing wrong. I mean, these are the same folks who brought us the terrorist watch list, 700,000 people. My goodness, how many terrorists do we really need? And, you know, Mead was talking earlier about secrecy. And this, you know, unfortunately, I mean, I have an emotional reaction to this, but I view this bill, Senate Bill 215, while it may have some good aspects to it, I think it is a backdoor to Real ID, and for that reason, I urge you to look very carefully at that, and I oppose it. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Question? Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, Bill, I apologize if I say Scannell. Okay, got it. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You want to put yourself on the record if you have an affiliation.
Absolutely. My name is Bill Scannell. I live at 8961 Winchester Street in Anchorage. I'm here as a private citizen, but also as someone who has personally fought national identification systems and passenger profiling systems, not only here but around the country, for going, embarrassingly enough, 5 years now, I've had to fight this stuff. I'd like to talk about what this bill really is, because it's quite unfortunate, everything that I've heard from Senator Huggins and Mr. Bannock, who I actually count as a friend as well. I think that they've grabbed the wrong end of the stick on this one, because this bill does not affect illegal immigrants or illegal aliens at all. None whatsoever. Illegal aliens and illegal immigrants can't get a driver's license in the state of Alaska today. What this bill does is it forces you and you and you and you and me and everybody else in this audience to prove we're American citizens, to prove who we are by pulling out our birth certificates and passports and high school yearbooks and whatever, that we need to prove that we are Americans. And I find that reprehensible. Why should we, as Americans, have to suffer through the indignity of having to prove that we have the right to be in our own country just because the federal government can't control the borders? I also apologize for not wearing my military ribbons today. I've never felt the need to wear them on my sleeve, but I spent 4 years, 2 months, 18 days in a wake-up as an intelligence officer in West Berlin. And I saw in the 80s, before the wall went down, what it meant when we were forced to carry papers over there, what it meant for, under communist countries, people having to prove who they were. This is appalling. And again, this bill does not affect illegal immigrants or illegal aliens whatsoever. It affects only American citizens. And Mr. McMorrin is quite right that this is the cornerstone of the Real ID Act. This is the cornerstone. Passing that will give the DMV tremendous powers to implement a national identification card for Alaskan citizens, and I find that equally reprehensible. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your thoughtful testimony. Okay, Matt. Go ahead and put yourself on the record as well.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Matthew Kerr, K-E-R-R, and I live in South Anchorage. I have also opposed this bill privately, representing myself, for the past several years. I believe that it is more than a legal presence bill. I wouldn't be entirely opposed to a legal presence bill, but as some of the other witnesses have said, that there are some more issues than that. My objections are mostly under two main categories. The first one is philosophical, and then the other is on the details of implementation. Philosophically speaking, this bill is certainly a path to Alaska's implementation of the Real ID Act, and for that reason alone, I would oppose it. I would say that it also doesn't accomplish a significant goal. illegal aliens are still permitted to drive in Alaska with their home country licenses. So I'm not sure what the strong benefit is to us. It fixes a problem that is not a significant problem in Alaska, and at the expense of increased bureaucracy in government, namely enforcing the charging the DMV with federal immigration enforcement, which I can relate, will later relate a couple secondhand stories of friends of mine that have experienced. It changes the meaning of a driver's license. There is nothing that you can do with a driver's license in this country that you cannot do with a foreign passport or a foreign driver's license, and I'm including things like flying on airplanes, filling out an I-9 employment eligibility form, things like that. And I don't support illegal immigration, but I also would not support a bill that made it illegal, that made it an additional crime for an illegal immigrant to be eating in a restaurant or riding on a bus or something like that. excuse me. Generally, I would prefer that other people on the road have licenses. Driver's licensing exists primarily for public safety, not for more than for an individual benefit. And if I was to do it, well, let's see. I'll continue then with the implementation details. Like I said, illegal immigrants can still drive legally in certain cases in this country. Of course, they're committing the crime of being here illegally, but that doesn't. But they are still permitted to drive legally with a foreign license for a certain period of time. I'd like to give a couple examples of how this bill could cause some serious issues. When a student is in this country, they are not instantly granted a period of stay necessarily equal to the period of their degree program. And so during the time that they're students, they receive something called an I-20 form, which is what actually dictates the length of their legal presence in this country. During your degree program, you will probably receive multiple I-20s, especially if you change majors, or if you take an extra time to graduate, or if you go into a graduate program. And I'd like to give you an example here. Last year I hired several immigration lawyers to speak with them about the issues that they thought about this. And there was one fantastic example where someone's I-20 could be in the mail. It doesn't arrive on the exact day that their previous one expired. They're still legally in the country, but they don't have evidence of that fact. Under this bill, their driver's license would expire, and let's pretend there's a worst case scenario. So over the weekend, let's say they get pulled over, they're then arrested for not having a valid operator's license. Their paperwork arrives on Monday, so then they are allowed to have a new license. But at that point, if they have a criminal record, then they become potentially deportable for committing the crime of having expired license, which expired even though they were legally in the country, because it took the university registrar, which is who issues these I-20 forms, a few extra days to have it done. If I was to create a legal presence bill, I would say that it perhaps is a fair compromise to require people applying for licenses and ID cards to show legal presence in the country at that time. I think there are far more difficulties with setting the expiration date at the exact date that period expires, but perhaps it would be a fair compromise to have them prove their legal presence upon the standard renewal period of 5 years that everybody else has, and I think that would eliminate some of those problems. I have two particular examples here. A friend of mine lived in Germany and did not have a license there because he lived in a large city that had public transportation, and it was financially prohibitive to obtain a license in Germany. He came to Alaska to visit, and of course he was legally present. He did not need a visa to come to this country, but when he went to the DMV, they had an extreme difficulty understanding how it was that he was in this country, and he ended up having to go DMV shopping to find one that would indeed issue him a license, even though he was legally present under the existing regulations in the state. Mm. Another one is that I know a friend of mine is a Russian foreign student in this country. Her passport was expired and renewed while she was here in this country, and so her current passport doesn't have a U.S. visa in it. She does have some paperwork to prove that she's legally present, but I can imagine that in the perfect world she would have no problem. But in this case, I could see there being additional difficulties and issues for her if she had to renew under these rules. And then finally, my final point is that several years ago, there was a large discussion about the methods of implementing this bill, and that the DMV would scan and retain imaged copies of every document used to obtain a driver's license. And as a computer programmer, that's my profession, I find that an extremely troubling proposition. And I would ask that if this bill or a similar one was to be implemented, that the DMV be specifically prohibited from retaining copies of people's identity documents, especially once they've been verified and made legitimate. I don't understand why we would need to keep those documents sitting in a computer system for many years after the fact. You know, once you've seen my passport, and once perhaps if you need to verify it, go ahead. But after that point, I don't see the compelling interest in retaining that information and keeping it around for people with bad intentions to later obtain through unscrupulous means.
Excellent points. Thank you very much, Matt. And if you decide you want to email us or email me, I would forward it to the committee. Mm-hmm. Any of the
Sure. I can come up with summary.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. I have a meeting. I know Senator Bundy has one. There's one more person, Senator Stevens and French. Are you okay? So just the last, and for Whitney and Carrie with the DMV, and Krista with the Attorney General's office, you can go ahead and go offline, and we'll hear from you next week. So the last person that's actually here in person.
Okay.
Okay.
Don't worry about it. We'll vote for you.
Okay. Good. You don't have three people.
Vin Harrison is. Are you with us, Vin?
My name is Jim. Yes.
Jim, I'm sorry, Jim. Go forward. And if you'd identify yourself, please.
Certainly. My name is Jim Harrison. I'm an attorney. I'm licensed to practice in the state of Alaska. I have considerable expertise in the area of identification-based security, domestic security programs, and in the legislation that various states have been passing to try and comply with Real ID. I come here at my own expense, and I'm glad to be here before you. I have a couple brief comments to make about this. One is to make sure it's clear to you that without this bill, it's understood that Alaska can't comply with Real ID. This contains what's called a legal presence requirement that people prove that they are citizens of the state of Alaska in order to get a driver's license or here under some sort of temporary basis. Real ID requires, and just to point out, Real ID final standards have been issued by the federal government to all the states. This was earlier this month, January 11th. It requires that the states require the people getting driver's licenses from them states to prove that they are citizens of the United States. Now, it's really important to realize that this is not, as other people pointed out, this is not just immigrants we're talking about. This is you, and this is you, and this is not just when you first get your driver's license. It's important to note in here that this deals with renewal of driver's licenses. So when you renew your driver's license, you're going to have to in person go in and prove that you are a United States citizen with the documents that you're granting through this piece of legislation. You're granting the DMV the authority to decide what documents should be required. You're essentially abdicating that or delegating that decision to the administration to make by regulation. That allows the DMV to just adopt Real ID standards, what documents are required. As it is now, you're going to have to bring in your birth certificate. You're going to have to bring in proof of legal presence. I mean, where you proof of residence, where you stay, and whatnot. Mr. Bannock, in testifying on this exact bill, and last year it was HB3. Here, Bob Lynn's bill was HB3. It had been changed because they felt as though the requirements that a person renewing their driver's license would have to prove that they're a citizen. They struck that from the bill, so the renewal part was removed. And Mr. Bannock's comment was that it would not, in a sense, allow DMV to be Real ID compliant. This is expensive. States automatically renew driver's licenses. You do it by mail, I assume, here in you can in Alaska. This would require essentially get rid of being able to automatically renew your driver's license. You have to appear in person. You have to swear under penalty of perjury that you say who you are. And per Real ID standards, they're going to make copies of the documents that you bring with you. That's expensive. I don't see a fiscal note on this bill. The cost associated with everybody in Alaska when they renew their driver's license to have to come in person, provide documents that they are an American citizen is a very expensive proposition. And I don't think that anyone has addressed that here. That's a lot of training of people and a lot of facilities that are going to get overrun with people that could have before renewed their driver's licenses by mail or whatnot. This is, let me talk a little bit about Real ID real briefly and what the federal government is saying they need it for. They're saying they need it for airplanes, getting on airplanes and for entering federal buildings and for entering nuclear facilities. I don't like the idea of anyone entering a nuclear facility only showing a driver's license, but they want to talk about it. There's a considerable danger of mission creep. Should Alaska buy on to Real ID, and should they say, oh, okay, aviation, it's important. They're now talking in D.C. about the use of Real ID for employees to verify the eligibility of their employers to verify the eligibility of their employees with significant penalties if they fail to do so. If Alaska buys into Real ID, the mission creep danger is really there. They're also talking about using these Real IDs to get your prescriptions filled. Identification-based security is not as good as physical security. Searching people for weapons or explosives is much more effective, and doing it randomly is much more effective than lists of secret lists of people on. You don't know how you get on them or off them, and it's just un-American to say that people have to affirmatively prove to the government satisfaction that they're not wanted on a list before they're able to freely move about their own country. That's un-American. And aside from that, I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I think we've touched on everyone. Anybody else that is here to testify before us? If not, Senator Huggins, some closing comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, we have heard both sides of the issue, heartfelt, on many of the people that testified and the convictions. And I share some of the concerns in the macro. When a census person comes around and I'm filling out the form, I am offended when they got this long category of what I look like and what my DNA and what my complexion might look like. I'm offended by that. It's about how many people in the country, so I don't fill out that portion. If my Social Security number is required someplace, I don't do that. If it's optional, there's a number of things I'm offended by that. I mean, I spent a few years in the Army myself, and serving the country, and I recognize and salute those that have done that. But let me just correct a couple things that we might not be exactly accurate. The information you've got. With or without this bill, if you're going to renew your driver's license, you got to go in to do it. Doesn't matter. Got to go in and do it. But here's the part I think is equally important. If you currently have a driver's license or an identification card and you're seeking renewal, a duplicate, or change of legal name, you're presumed to meet the requirements of this bill if the license have not been expired more than 90 days, and has not been canceled, suspended, or revoked, and the person has not been disqualified from obtaining a license. So there's some presumption there. So just because if this bill passes, we do not all have to run down to DMVA to get a new license. Not the case. There are other elements. I myself have a lot of libertarian in my bones and my family heritage, and I'm not supportive of the concept of a national identification card at this point in time. And when people talk about flying on airplanes, I'll get out my Army OD wallet, overfilled. When I fly on an airplane, I use that card. It's my military identification card. I don't use my driver's license. And I'm not sure what the provisions going forward are, but the only identification to get on an airplane is not your driver's license. It's not just an identification card issued by the state of Alaska. There are other forms. So for those that are concerned about that, as I share some of their concerns, this doesn't create that sort of obstacle in my estimation. And I am very protective, both from the mentality and the actual enactment of provisions that would create something of that nature. So, if there are things in here that have some malleability that should be modified to some degree to protect Alaskans, we're willing to entertain that and make those as appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huckins. Any questions? We will hold this bill over. The chairwoman will let you know when it's going to be dealt with again. Thank you all for being here. Minute adjourned.